Welcome to the podcast ministry of Grace Anglican Church in Grove City, Pennsylvania. It is our hope to proclaim the historic faith and the dazzling grace of Jesus Christ. For more information about our church, please check out our website at graceanglicanonline.com.
My uncle, in his younger years, bred draft horses, big, huge Belgians. I mean, some of the biggest horses I think you've ever seen. They were absolutely huge. And you know, the funny thing about draft horses is just how strong they are and how smart they are. You know, if you team two draft horses together, you know, they don't just pull double the amount of weight. They actually pull exponentially more weight together. You get four of them, and it's not just four times more, it's exponentially more weight the four draft horses can pull. But draft horses are also very sensitive creatures, and they can, despite their size and their strength, get discouraged very easily. They have a lot of power, but sometimes they just give out. And there's an anecdotal story about draft horses that goes something like this. A farmer had a team that was pulling a lot of logs on a heavy sledge, and they came to a rough patch on a dirt road, and they had to go uphill and over some rougher terrain, and they couldn't do it. They got stuck. And so the farmer decided to take a few logs off, lighten the load. So he lightens the load, and they couldn't do it. Lightens it a little bit more, and they couldn't do it. And he keeps lightening the load to the point that there are no more logs on the sledge, and the draft horses couldn't do it. They had lost hope. They lost confidence that they were actually going to get through this task that was before them. And maybe, just maybe, you feel a bit like a draft horse. Hopefully, you don't look like a draft horse, but you may feel like one. You may feel like that you have had in your life rough patch after rough patch, whether it be health or children or marriage or career or the lack of those things. Whatever it may be, there's a very good chance that you wake up some days and you think, you know what? I'm just going to go back to bed because I'm tired. Isaiah, in Isaiah 42, I think Isaiah is speaking to a beleaguered and tired people of Israel. They are Babylonian captives, and they've been there for a long time. And they were a people gifted by God with his law, with his blessing, with his protection. They had all the power they needed to accomplish their task, but they failed, and they were taken away into captivity. And I imagine they're at a point where they think it is all hopeless. There's nothing left for us to do but just lay down and die. And Isaiah, in our passage today, gives them a sign of hope. He starts talking about this servant. There are four servant passages. Some people say five, but at least four servant passages in Isaiah. This is the first of those, where Isaiah begins to talk about this servant who will come from God to rescue his people. Behold, my servant, who I'm uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. Tonight I want to talk about the servant. I want to talk about three things: who, what, and how. It's a really simple outline. Who, what, and how. Who are we talking about? What is he doing? And how is he going to do it? Isaiah 41, verses 8 through 10, identifies the servant of God in that passage as Israel. But you, Israel, my servant Jacob, whom I have chosen, the offspring of Abraham, my friend, you whom I took from the ends of the earth and called from its farthest corner, saying to you, you are my servant. I have chosen you and not cast you off. Fear not, for I am with you. Be not dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. I will help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. In Isaiah 41, we have the servant identified as Israel. They were called by God to be a nation of priests, a people who serve as a lighthouse to the world, the lighthouse of God. God's law has been given to them. God's righteousness has been revealed through them. They are called. They have promises. And God is reminding them that they are his servants. After our passage today of 42 verses 1 through 9, we also see that Israel has failed. They've failed. Hear you deaf and look you blind that you may see. Who is blind but my servant, or deaf as my messenger whom I send? Who is blind as my dedicated one, or blind as the servant of the Lord? He sees many things but does not observe them. His ears are open, but he does not hear. So this servant called by God is in captivity because of their sin. In between those two passages, the first recounting God's blessing to Israel, and this second passage recounting Israel's failure, is this servant passage that we're going to look at tonight. The focus begins to shift just a little bit. God has promised a great deal to the people of Israel. But they failed, and they stand as a stand-in for you and I. They represent you and me. Matthew clearly identifies the servant as being Jesus. In Matthew chapter 12, Jesus is aware that the Pharisees are conspiring against him. So Jesus, aware of this, withdrew from there, and many followed him, and he healed them all and ordered them not to make him known. This was to fulfill what was spoken by the prophet Isaiah. Behold, my servant whom I have chosen, my beloved with whom my soul is well pleased. I will put my spirit upon him, and he will proclaim justice to the Gentiles. He will not quarrel or cry aloud, nor will anyone hear his voice in the streets. A bruised reed he will not break, and a smoldering wick he will not quench until he brings justice to victory, and in his name the Gentiles have hope. Matthew clearly identifies this servant of Isaiah 42 as being Jesus Christ. And so God realizes that his people Israel have failed and that they are without hope unless he sends a servant from himself to take care of them and to lift them out of their dark, dark malaise. He says about this servant, behold, my servant whom I uphold, my chosen, in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. Jesus comes into this creation not just to bring justice to the beleaguered people of Israel, but to bring justice to the nations. God's plan was never just to save Israel. It was always to save the entire world. Now, picture yourself as a Jewish person in Babylonian captivity. You really do want some justice in this situation. It would be really nice if the Babylonians would just follow Yahweh. Wouldn't your life as a Jewish captive become so much easier? And so this hope of salvation, this hope of redemption that is promised not just to the Jews, but to the Gentiles, is in the Old Testament, a sign of hope and positive things for the Jew. Unlike the Pharisees who see Jesus as a threat, Isaiah saw the coming of this servant as a blessing. He was there to save the Jews and to save the world, and therefore make the Jews' lives a whole lot easier. Because he comes to bring the what? He comes to bring justice. Justice for humanity, including the Gentiles. Justice is mentioned three times in these first four verses. He will bring justice to the nations. He will not bruise the reed or quench the wick until he faithfully bring forth justice in verse 3. And verse 4, he will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth. And the coastlands wait for his law. The coastlands is a term referring to the Gentiles who live out there somewhere. They wait for the righteousness of God. And so he's bringing this righteousness. Well, what is it? First, this justice that Isaiah mentions is not something that we will ultimately establish. It isn't something that we can establish in the utopian left or the libertarian right. I made the mistake of buying a commentary this week from a guy who turned out to be kind of a liberal, and it was a waste of $30. But I want to comment on what he said about this passage because it's very telling. He says this, justice, the Hebrew word is mishpat. He says, mishpat is the order of compassionate justice that God has created and upon which the wholeness of the universe depends. So all of the universe depends on God's justice. In Israel, God revealed Mishpat in the form of the Torah. He gave us his justice in the law. Pretty good. Those who repudiate God's Mishpat introduce evil into the world. So those who do not follow God's law introduce evil. There's no sense here in this commentator that sin is something that we're born with, or that a sin nature is something that we're born with. Sin is something only that we do that brings evil into existence, into the world. Then he says this, and to restore the harmony, God acts through God's servants to nullify the power of evildoers and to restore the harmony that arises where God's mishpat is acknowledged and observed. Do you understand what he's saying there? This author doesn't think that the servant is Jesus. He ignores Matthew. He doesn't address any of these things. This is what happens. This is why preachers get so upset about progressive theology, because they want to get rid of Jesus, because they think that prophecies can't be true, because they think that Jesus is mostly a myth. The things about him are mostly a myth. They have to disregard that. So this commentator ignores Matthew's comments about Jesus being the servant of Isaiah 42. And he says that the servant in Isaiah 42 is Israel. And because Israel has failed, it really is broader than just Israel. It's all the people who would follow God. So what he has done is when he has removed Jesus from the equation, and he has made you and I the hero of the story. You and I restore God's kingdom when we push back against the evil of the world. When Jesus is taken out of the equation, all we're really left with is a sort of moralism that says we have to fight back against all the evil of the world so that we can usher in the kingdom of God. Now, I'm not saying that we're not supposed to live out God's righteousness in the world. What I am saying is we're not the center of the show. We are not the hero. Because trust me, if you and I, well, maybe me, but if you're the hero of the story, we're all in big trouble. It's no wonder that we live in this anxious age, right? We all feel it. We're going through this period in our own nation where we're just anxious and we're upset. And you've got these extremes of people sort of yelling at each other. And everyone thinks that we have a political problem or a president problem, or we just have the wrong policies. We have the wrong theology. We've actually made ourselves the hero. Whether you're on the far left or the far right, if you think it is your job to fix the world, that you speak for God instead of Jesus speaking for God, if you think that you speak for God, then everyone who speaks against you must be speaking for Satan. And that's how we become polarized, by putting ourselves at the center of the story instead of putting Christ at the center of the story. The servant is Jesus, and the servant has come to bring justice. So if justice is not this utopian idealism or this libertarian idealism, this idea that we somehow, through our proper actions, will establish God's kingdom, God's justice, then what is it? Well, I think one of the things we have to look at, a small little verse, Deuteronomy 32:4, the rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are justice, a God of faithfulness and without iniquity, just and upright is he. That short little verse summarizes the idea of the Old Testament, that God's righteousness and God's judgment, justice, are almost synonymous. Righteousness is a characteristic of God. It's a character quality. His justice is how that's expressed when it comes into humanity. So when the Old Testament speaks of justice, it's speaking of the righteousness of God as it is displayed among humans, as he wants it followed among humans. And so if that is the definition of justice, that the justice of God is actually the righteousness of God displayed, then we already know that we can't do that. More laws will not make that better. We've already had the Old Testament law, and as we've discussed, Israel failed miserably. The justice of God as the expression of the righteousness of God is something ultimately that only God can complete. And so Christ is the servant who is sent to establish justice. And so I agree with the commentator to some extent. Justice is the order of God's righteous rule over all that he created. God laid out what his righteous justice looks like in his law. Those who reject the law facilitate evil. I don't want to say they introduce evil, because evil was already introduced at the fall. They facilitate evil in the world, because when we reject God's righteousness and his righteous standards, we are in fact rejecting the righteous and rightful rule of God in this creation. And so when we put ourselves at the center of the story, we end up making a mess of it. And if the Old Testament and the Jewish experience tells us nothing, it's that we needed a salvation that comes from radically outside of us. And this is what Isaiah is saying to the people of Israel, the Babylonian captives. It's really bad right now. You're a captive in a foreign land. You know, as a nation that's never been defeated by a foreign power on its own soil, we have no idea what this is like. To be dragged away from our homes, to even have that as a threat. Even most of the threats in the world that we perceive as threats are most likely not going to take us away from our homes. We are profoundly secure, particularly compared to these Jewish people living in a foreign land. And so the who is Jesus, the what is justice, and the how. How will he accomplish it? And I have to tell you, these first four verses of Isaiah 42 are absolutely beautiful. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands wait for his law. You're the people of Israel in Babylon. Compare what you've just read there with what the Babylonians have done. They've dragged you away. They've crushed your civilization. They've taken your leaders. They've taken your princes. They've made you into a foreign people in a foreign land. They have been harsh. But this servant has an entirely different approach to how his law will be established. First, we see that he has the power of God upon him. Behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen, and whom my soul delights. This should remind us of the baptism of Jesus. And when Jesus was baptized, immediately he went up from the water, and behold, the heavens were open to him, and he saw the Spirit of God descending like a dove and coming to rest on him, and behold, a voice from heaven said, "This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased." Jesus has the power of God and the authority of God and the power of the Holy Spirit behind him, backing him, pushing him forward, and upholding him. He does it first by the power of God. He does it also with a quiet confidence. He will not, it says, cry aloud in the streets. He does it with the quiet confidence that knows that he has authority. Do you remember? Think back to the Gospels. You remember all the various stories about Jesus, how Jesus just kind of tells it like it is. Pharisees confront him. He gives them very direct answers. They seek to kill him. He leaves. He doesn't stick around. He doesn't try to fight. He doesn't debate. When he's taken away to be executed, he doesn't fight back. He answers Pilate's questions directly with very short answers, almost frustratingly so. He answers almost none of the accusations. He simply says, "I'm the Son of God, and I've been sent here for this." There's a confidence that he has because he knows where his authority comes from. If you're ever in a position of authority and you have to tell people you're in a position of authority, you either A, are not very secure, or two, you're not really in authority. This has happened to me early in my ministry career. I was not long out of seminary, and I had a volunteer youth worker who happened to be an active duty colonel in the U.S. Army. And his favorite thing to do was to tell me what to do. And this went on for a while. And I was really insecure. I mean, this guy was the same age as my father. He was a colonel. He was telling me what to do constantly. I mean, he had a rule book like this that was really awesome about how we were supposed to hug and like shake hands. I mean, I kid you not, he wrote like a youth manual based on the Army's Code of Conduct book and gave it to me. He was like, we need to implement this in the youth group. And that was sort of the beginning of the end, I'll be honest. But I was really insecure, so I like had a meeting with him, and the best thing I could do was tell him, like, listen, I'm the guy they hired. I know you don't like me, but tough, I'm here. Here's the thing. When you come to the point with a confrontation with someone where you have to play that card, the game's already over. The game's already over. You've already lost. And, you know, they left the church thereafter, and the relationship broke apart. And honestly, it was nice. My life got easier. But that's the thing that Jesus never had to do that. Jesus just said, I'm the Messiah. I'm the Son of God. And I'm going to Jerusalem, which means I'm going to die. And he never felt the need to get defensive or to argue over it. He just was who he was, and he knew who he was. And so Jesus comes, the servant comes with a sort of quiet confidence that knows who he is and knows why he's here. And that same Messiah is your Lord and Savior. He knows what he's here for. He knows why he's here. He knows why he's in your life, and he knows what he wants for you. He has a confidence about him, and you can have confidence in him. Personally, I like that kind of Jesus. I don't want the insecure Jesus. I really want the one that's like in charge and knows it. He's the quiet and humble servant. He also comes with gentleness and compassion. He speaks of bruised reeds and faintly burning wicks. You can picture this illustration. It's really a pretty simple one. If you've ever been around reeds at the waterside, like cattails or something like that, you know that they're hollow and they're kind of fragile. And any little bit of damage to the outside of that stalk can cause that reed to collapse and fall over. He's saying to a beleaguered people of Israel, and by extension, the beleaguered Gentiles of the world, you and me, that when he comes, for those who are oppressed and beaten down by life, by their own sin and by the sin of others, he's not here to crush you. He's not here to damage and destroy what has already been hurt. He talks about the faintly burning wick, you know, the candle that's just barely hanging on, that just the slightest little breeze can blow out. He says, I'm not going to blow that out. I'm going to fan it back to life. You may be there. You may be at this point in life where you're the bruised reed or the faintly burning wick, and you're just tired. And if one more thing happens, you're done. Like, give me a cup of coffee and put me back in my pajamas. I'm not going out to live life today. Or worse. One more thing. And yet we see in Jesus example after example of this care for the bruised reed and care for the slightly burning wick. We see it, the leper in Matthew 8, a diseased man cast out by society, shunned by everyone, a leper who lived in a leper colony. You see this in Matthew, you see it in Mark. Jesus goes out of his way not only to minister to those kind of sick outcasts, the kind of people who nobody else wanted to be around, but he actually touches them. He reaches out and puts hands on the dirty, filthy, diseased people. We see it in the demon-possessed man of Mark chapter 5, who is living among the tombs, a living man living as if he were dead. And he brings him back to life. We see it. We see it in the woman caught in adultery in John chapter 8. She is about to be stoned for her sin, and according to the laws of the day, she deserved it. It was righteous and it was good. And he shows mercy on her and says, go and sin no more. We see it in the synagogue ruler, Jairus, whose little daughter was dying. He asked Jesus to put his hands on her before she died. And before Jesus got there, he comes to the woman with the issue of blood, and he lays hands on her and calls her out and heals this woman in front of everyone. A woman, again, who was unclean and dirty and no one wanted to be around. And then he goes and raises a little girl, heals a sick little girl. He comes for the bruised reeds and the slightly smoldering wicks. He comes for the people who have at various times just given up. Who, even though logically you're the draft horse, you've got all the power, you should be able to pull through this, but you can't. You can't. And he comes for you. He comes for you. And he does it with determination and perseverance. It says he will, the last few verses there, he will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth and the coastlands wait for this law, wait for his law. That means a lot to me as I find myself increasingly frustrated with the state of things in our country and in our society. I find myself increasingly frustrated with the vitriol and the anger. I think, how long, Lord? Like, I'm tired. I'm tired of these arguments and these discussions. I'm tired of having to defend you and defend the church and defend myself. Like, I'm just tired. How long? But he keeps pulling and keeps working with determination and perseverance. And his mission to establish God's justice, God's righteousness on this earth will not be set aside. It will not be stopped. And so as we enter into this Epiphany season, where Jesus is revealed to the nations, we praise God during this season. Because we were like the beleaguered people with nothing on the outside. And God thought enough of us to send his servant for us too. And so we get included in all the blessings. And so I want to encourage you. I want to encourage you to have faith and have courage and have strength. Not in yourself, because you're not the hero. And that is a really good thing. Put your faith in Jesus Christ. Trust and rest in him and what he will do in you and through you. Come here.